Light it up.
Welcome to Unmistakably Star Wars, your source for a high-quality, informative, and entertaining look into the Star Wars galaxy. So strap yourself in, because here's where the fun begins.
Barb, when I bring up the name Robert Ballard, does it ring any bells for you? Robert Ballard?
No.
Wow, that's disappointing. Gina, how about for you? Does the name Robert Ballard do anything for you?
Not at all.
Unbelievable. Okay, so Robert Ballard was a deep sea exploration expert. And it took him, he was the first one to discover the wreckage of Titanic, 70 years to find the wreckage of the Titanic.
Oh, I remember when that happened.
Yeah.
And it was all in National Geographic and
right.
all of that.
Exactly,
yeah.
exactly. And of course, it later became kind of a parallel story for the whole James Cameron Titanic thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it took him 70 years to find the Titanic wreckage. And he was such an enthusiast that he looked at this challenge, this hunt, as something that would just kind of drive him for the better part of 5-6 years or more. I'm going to segue into my own little attempt to find something that was long lost. When the Last Jedi came around, as listeners to this podcast well know, that I kind of have this affinity for this character, Phasma, to the extent of I actually named my puppy Phasma when we got her last October. And the one Phasma prize that had eluded me, and I know, Barb, as we're in the studio here, you're going to probably laugh at this, but the one Phasma prize that eluded me was the Captain Phasma labeled can of Campbell's soup. It's a great piece of Americana. I collect the Campbell's soup. I've got them all from The Force Awakens, but I could never find Phasma. There was a point before The Last Jedi came out where I went to every supermarket within our county looking for it. Literally took all of the Campbell's soup off the shelf to look for it.
That's right? Dedication.
Dedication is one word.
Obsession.
I was in our local Target, which is, quite frankly, folks, notoriously rinky-dink. It's a very small Target.
Oh.
It's barely larger than a bullseye. See what I did there? And I just happened to be in there last weekend, and I was getting some supplies for my daughter's birthday cake, of which I'm going to be baking later this week. And there it was.
Are you serious?
There was one Captain Phasma can of Campbell's soup. And I had this moment, not to cross universes here, but I had this kind of Indiana Jones looking at the golden statue of fertility there, just kind of looking at it and kind of like weighing it in my mind, like I'm just going to have to place a bag of sand on there and get out of there before like poisonous darts came out of the walls. But nonetheless, I got, for all I know, the only can of Captain Phasma Campbell's soup that ever existed in Santa Cruz County, California. So as you can see, Barb, if you turn around, it is now on the shelf next to the rest of Phasma stuff. So I feel accomplished, and I feel that Robert Ballard, the finder of the Titanic wreckage, I think we are forever bonded with our parallel adventures. There's no doubt about it.
I can't believe you went all over the county looking for that.
Some people might say I'm a bit of an obsessive compulsive. They would be accurate. Yeah. Hey, listen. I can't afford like the sideshow collectible Captain Phasma, so give me the $1.69 Campbell's soup. So there it is.
Does soup not go bad? Can it just sit on your shelf?
I think it probably can survive a nuclear blast. The Twinkies can, certainly soup.
I mean, technically they have an expiry date on them, but
yeah,
it's like
technically
10 years.
Oh, okay.
My doctor scale technically reads higher than my bathroom scale. That doesn't mean anything. Technically. Oh, my goodness. Well, my little tauntauns, welcome to this episode of Unmistakably Star Wars. My name is Devin Klepper. I am your curator of content for this evening journey. And as you are already well aware, joining me in the USW World Headquarters, the one and only Barb the Canadian.
That's me. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Barb, I just have to ask again, since we're at the top of the show here, you know, when you arrived, Phasma, my dog, actually was barking quite a bit. Do you think that that had to do with stranger danger? Do you think the fact that you're Canadian that she began to bark?
Always back to being Canadian. I think you've got a well-trained guard dog right there.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
She appreciates that.
She has no idea I'm Canadian.
Yeah, well, yet. Wait till she hears this episode. Also joining us from the 618, the always fantastic, and might I just say, always prepared, one only, Regina Sanders. Gina, welcome.
Hi, everyone.
Oh, my goodness. Hey, we've got some fun. You know, we're in this weird time period, as we've mentioned the last couple of weeks, where sometimes we got to kind of stretch and see, but we actually got a couple of nuggets of really cool news this past week in the news cycle. So, first and foremost, you got to cue Michael Stipe and REM because it is maybe the end of the world, or at least the end of Galaxy's Edge, as we know. We're going to talk about that. Bob Iger had some things to say as far as the lack of attendance at Galaxy's Edge. And then Disney Plus news is released finally, but is the real news a minus for Disney? Barb, do you see what I did with that sentence? I flipped that on its head just like that. And also, John Williams, you might remember him from 8 of the top 10 musical scores of all time.
You will never let that die.
If he was truly good, he would have got 10 out of 10.
Oh, my gosh.
He's going to give us 135 reasons why we're going to love The Rise of Skywalker. We're going to get into that. And then our closer look topic, we're wrapping up this mini-series, part 2 of 2. Last week, we talked about why the Disney era Star Wars is the best Star Wars. So we're going to turn back the clock a little bit tonight. And in part 2, we're going to talk about why pre-Disney Star Wars is the best Star Wars, which will be interesting, especially if we start to make some computations between the original trilogy and the prequels. So with that, let's jump into our top 3 news stories of the week.
Number 3.
We finally got some news from Disney regarding this little streaming service that they're going to launch here. Yeah, it seems like it's like right around the corner.
Yeah.
School has started in many areas. I went back actually last week, and it fall is in the air. At least it is out here. Gina, I don't think fall is quite in the air in the 618 yet. Am I right?
No, it's still hot and it's still summer, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's a bummer. That's a bummer. Listen, though, we got some news, and Disney finally came out and said Disney Plus is going to begin in November, and it's going to cost you $12.99. For that bargain basement price, you're going to get Disney Plus, you're going to get ESPN, and you're also going to get Hulu, which is now at least mostly owned by Disney, I believe. Mm-hmm. So, listen, Barb, let me just begin with you. $12.99 is actually what I think most people thought was a little high. Bob Iger had talked and gave us kind of information prior that made us think, oh, it's probably going to be closer to like $5 or $6 a month. Of course, that was as a standalone.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's bundled with Hulu. It's bundled with ESPN, which is an ABC company, which is ultimately a Disney company. $12.99, is that the good price point for you, Barb, or no?
Oh, with this bundle, I think it's a steal.
Really?
Well, because I've experienced Hulu, and what Hulu has to offer is, I'm going to keep it clean, but just a heck of a lot.
Yeah.
You can watch a lot of stuff on Hulu.
Yeah.
And then that combined with being able to watch sports,
mm-hmm.
and then everything that Disney's going to throw at us from the vault and everything that Disney owns on the Disney Plus service. I mean, other than Netflix and Netflix content, you don't need anything. You don't need cable. You don't need anything else, in my opinion. This is great.
I see, and that's some of the parts that fascinates me. I'm just still trying to process in my mind. I recently began watching The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu. Got hooked. Put it off forever. Didn't think it was going to interest me. Got hooked. Binging it. I'm in the middle of season 3 right now. Can't wait to finish it.
Yeah.
That being said, though, I'm curious if, like, I don't really watch sports anymore. If I listen to a baseball game on the radio, I consider that totally golden. I love that. So the ESPN part doesn't really do much for me to move the needle. I am a fan of Hulu. Mm-hmm. I've enjoyed using Eve's login. I'll just go on the record and say that. Thank you, Eve. From your perspective, Gina, is this a good price point for the graduate student that's going to be able to watch sports plus all the Hulu and Disney Plus stuff?
Yeah, so I also mooch off my Hulu. I use my dad's Hulu, so this is so this is pretty interesting to me, but someone in my family already pays for it. I wonder, so a lot of my friends have Spotify, and I know Spotify has a deal with Hulu where I think the student price is $5, and then Hulu's like also a cheaper price. So I wonder how it'll go for students who get like other discounts. But like that aside, this sounds absolutely perfect.
I like that. And I'm just looking at Hulu right now. So as a standalone, which is mainly its own programming plus a few of the basic things, that they start off at $5.99, and then it goes up if you want up to the live TV service, is going to start at around $45 a month. I'm curious though, and Regina, let me just stay with you though, and maybe we should actually like call your dad and get him in on this. But so one of the things is it begs the question that so many people were dropping cable and getting subscription services, and now it's at a point where like you have to be careful, because if you've got too many subscription services, you're actually probably paying as much or more than some cable packages. So for you or for your dad, do you think that you're going to have to make cuts in other areas, be it Netflix or any other packages of either subscription services or cable that you currently have?
I mean, probably. I've noticed how many – so you got the news articles later that was like Friends, which I don't watch, but Friends is going to leave Netflix and all these things because it's going to its own streaming services. And for a second, I was wondering, what's the point of having all these streaming services when we could just have cable? I think part of the appeal is still the fact that it's ready and right there. So for cable, you have to like wait for it to be on television. And with the streaming services, you could just click the show and watch the episodes that you want. And so I feel like at this point in time, it's still good to pretty much abandon your cable and stick with these different packages.
Barb, you're nodding. You're in agreement with that?
Yeah, I mean, today's culture is very, you know, push a button, instant gratification.
Right.
And for people who are growing up with that, and the younger generation especially, they're used to that. They're not used to cable and then having to watch commercials.
Yeah.
And
wait a week for the next episode.
And wait a week for the next episode. Although Hulu has released some of their original shows every week.
Yeah.
HBO still does that.
Right.
But just being able to watch it when you want, once it's become available, is a big clincher for so many people today. And instead of, what time is it on? We have to get home at 9 o'clock. Like, that's 80s and 90s. That's not today.
Right. That's true. Thursday night TV,
yeah.
Right? Let me ask this then. So, Barb, if it comes to looking at what you're paying for with Disney Plus and Netflix, you mentioned HBO, which I know a lot of other folks have got. Do you see having to drop one? Or are you seeing like, no, we're just going to add it to what we've already got?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. For our family, for our household, we definitely don't need our bills increasing. so we need to juggle something. And, you know, whether it be your internet service provider, whatever it is you're paying, we need it to balance out. So something's going to have to either go, but I can't drop Netflix. There's too many Netflix originals, like Stranger Things, that I'm just not willing to give up.
Yeah.
We'll see what Netflix looks like after Disney pulls all of their content, because it's going to look a little bare.
Well, that's one of the things that Jeremy and I were talking about today, instead of doing what we're supposed to be doing as teachers. and we a couple things came out. One was, he said that like he'll probably drop his HBO streaming subscription. Like that'll be the first thing to go. And then he said, you know, when it comes to Netflix, if this Disney Plus thing is a success, will other studios, Universal, Paramount, so on and so forth, will they start their own streaming services? And will Netflix basically just become, it makes its own product, but it's not purchasing licenses to play other movie houses' products? So would, for you, Barb, would Netflix be alluring enough if all it was Netflix original programming? Is it good enough for you? I'm looking at their site right now, and they have three packages, starting at $9, going to $13, and then their premium package is $16, which is going to give you Ultra HD and multiple screens and all that.
I guess it would really depend on, you know, if it's only Netflix originals that you're talking about, it depends on the cost. Are they going to lower the cost? But you made an interesting point that I don't think will actually happen. Disney creating its own streaming service, Disney Plus. Disney is such a monopoly of so much that it can do that, and people will want that.
Yeah.
When you start looking at some of the smaller companies like Paramount or Universal, I don't think they're big enough to compete with what Disney can put out there on its streaming service. So I think Netflix is still going to have content that's not Netflix originals that it can put out there.
Well, it'll be interesting because Comcast is one of the biggest conglomerates in the world, and they, of course, own NBC, Universal, and all the subsidiaries, MTV, and all the things that fall under that umbrella. So it will be interesting if indeed it comes time to start looking at what's going to stay on Netflix and other streaming services and what's going to go. Gina, from your perspective, as we kind of wrap up this story for the week, is there anything else, I guess, that Netflix or Hulu could do to woo you to stay with them as individuals and not go to Disney Plus? Or is Disney Plus just, and listen, anybody that's listening to this podcast knows that you would pay the $12.99 just to see Pedro Pascal. We get that. That notwithstanding, though, is the Disney Plus just too good of an opportunity for, I'm using air quotes here in the studio once again, but the average moviegoer, whether or not you're a Star Wars fan?
Oh, in fact, the first day I told them, my family, my friends, I was getting the year subscription thing. I don't have to go through a month.
Boom.
Because one of the things that appealed to me about Hulu and Netflix was I like to just sit down and watch a lot of movies. And if movies are being taken off to go to their individual things, well, most of the movies I watch are Disney, Marvel, Star Wars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of fascinating when you start thinking about, here are the movies I enjoy. Oh, it's Disney. Oh, it's Marvel. Oh, it's this, it's that. And how many ultimately lead back up to the Mouse House?
Exactly.
It's kind of crazy. It's kind of crazy. We're going to get more into that in just a second. So let's trek along with our next news story of the week.
Number two.
All right. A couple sources have reported that John Williams has said that he is in the midst of scoring episode 9. The Rise of Skywalker, and that he is writing and will be performing 135 musical minutes. Now, we know Star Wars is heavy on the soundtrack, right? It is its own character. As David Collin put it, I believe, he said that it is oxygen, right? Mm-hmm. We don't know if this is the actual runtime of the movie. There's probably some additional footage that's happening that doesn't have any music in it. But let's take this roughly 135 minutes. That's a pretty good runtime, especially if it might actually trickle over that a little bit for those moments that don't have music. When we hear this, Gina, is that kind of in that sweet spot as far as the length of the film that you think is going to be necessary to finish this saga?
Yes and no.
Well said.
I want enough time for the correct and proper story to be told, but I also don't want it to just lag out and just so we can have moments of fan service. So for now, I'm going to say yes, but don't hold me to it.
Okay. And I won't. Barb will, on the other hand. So Barb, let me ask you. So 135 minutes, right? So that's roughly in the ballpark of the other Star Wars films that we've had as far as overall runtime. Is this the sweet spot here? Do you think that we're going to go much over this?
That it's hard to say. I think, you know, the entire film is not scored. I know that Star Wars is heavy on score. So, you know, with credits and music going all the way to the end of credits and stuff. But I think it's going to be a little longer than that. And I don't think that they're going to do this to pay service to the fans at all. Mm-hmm. you know, one of the comments that's in this article is all about how he's using themes from every single Star Wars.
Right, right.
That's incredible and insane at the same time to use every single theme in one movie.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I think that that is the other kind of branch of the story that's really fascinating to me. And is there, I guess, when we think about that, like the first thing that I thought of was like, we're going to get like Duel of the Fates. We're going to like, that's going to come back and like have that in episode 9. This is kind of crazy. Then of course, some of the other people on social media said, so we're going to have the princess and we're going to have all these other things that we're so familiar with. Barb, when you hear or rather read stuff like that, like what does that kind of do to your understanding of what we're going to see for episode 9?
We're going to see a lot. Like, I know, but I can't wrap my head around what that looks like.
Yeah.
You know, I believe in the article or something I was reading today, it said that they'll be visiting a lot of places from past Star Wars movies. Yeah. And I'm just interested in how this story is going to go, that they're going to need to go to all of these places. I mean, from the preview that we've seen, we know that we see what we believe is the second Death Star destroyed on what has to be Endor.
Sure.
You know, so there's a past planet, so we'll get some themes from there. It's just, I want to think about what this means for the story and why all these themes are going to be intertwined into it.
Yeah.
And I don't. There's, you know, I just still want to wait the 4 months and get my mind blown.
Yeah. Well, and I guess common sense would say, like, John Williams is not going to get up there and just play a medley, right? He's not going to, like, mash everything together and be like, all right, let's take the Cantina Band and match it with Max Rebo for their reunion tour. Regina, when you see this and think in terms of, like, oh, my gosh, we're really going to see some of these major themes come back, is there a theme that, I guess, would just blow your mind the most to hear that play out in episode 9?
Where's Across the Stars going to play? That's what I need to know. That's the theme.
Good question. I don't know.
Because it means someone's in love. Who can be in love? I don't know.
I don't know, but if it's five letters and rhymes with Malo, I don't want to see that.
Well, I mean, that's when I start thinking about, like, the Maul music, you know, when he appears in one of those scenes we were talking about recently. Right. I'm like, how does that play in?
Well, and in fairness, he's talking about themes, so I don't know that he's qualifying that as a quote-unquote theme or not.
Mm-hmm.
We, of course, have, you know, Binary Sunset is Luke's theme, and we've got Leia's theme, and we've got Rey's theme, and so many other themes that are actually
There's so many themes in the prequels that aren't in the rest of the movies.
Sure.
That I, you know, as Gina has said, like, how does that play out?
Yeah. Do you think he dabbles at all with the film that he didn't score with Rogue One?
I don't know.
I would say he probably wouldn't cross over into that. No. But it'd be interesting, because that's got some incredible music. I mean, the theme of Jedha is one of my favorites of all. I mean, it makes my top 10 easily.
Your top 10?
My top 10.
Okay.
You want me to name them for you in order?
No. I was just going to say, you know, I was going to make a joke and it wasn't funny. Keep going.
Barb is straight out of Wompton tonight. With that in mind, Barb, is there a specific theme that if it plays in the midst of episode 9 that, I don't know, it makes your heart pitter-patter or you get a tear? What is the one theme that's going to just pierce your heart the most if it happens?
Well, we already know that Leia's theme is going to be played.
Yeah.
And that pierced my heart like crazy in the preview. Just because it's Leia, it's Carrie Fisher, it, you know, and that music alone makes me tear up.
Yeah.
But there's also, I don't know if it's called Yoda's theme. What's the theme music in Return of the Jedi, when Yoda dies?
I don't know the title of it right
Yeah, off. I'd have to look on my music here, but that theme music would get me right away.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you think, or let me kind of rephrase that, how do you think we might see the Imperial March brought into this, if at all?
Well, we know that somehow Palpatine plays a role in the movie.
Or at least the trailer.
It has to harken back to something from the Empire.
Okay. Yeah.
Not just the First Order,
yeah.
But something, I don't know if it's related to Kylo bringing something back or someone, or it's just going to look back to the Empire in some way, and that would be where we get that theme.
Of course, we know we're getting Sith troopers, so there's all kinds of ways. It'll be interesting, too. Mm-hmm. I'd be willing to bet, well, Barb, I'd be willing to bet your entire bank account, that when we say or read that these themes are going to be in there, it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to hear the entire theme from start to finish, right?
Oh,
it could
no,
just be
true.
The smallest nuance of a theme, which you get that with Vader's theme in other parts beyond Empire.
And Williams could be composing some together and meshing them.
Yeah.
And not doing what you said where he's just going to throw all
of
them.
Yeah, it's not a medley, right?
Yeah, not a medley, but he is composing music that could string together.
Regina, I'm curious. This is potentially pretty cool news to hear this, to read this. Do you think that John Williams is going to write something new for The Rise of Skywalker that is potentially going to become a fan favorite?
I think so, just because he said he wasn't making any more music for any of the future Star Wars films after this one, I'm pretty sure.
Right.
Besides having some of the old things that fans and probably he cherishes and loves, it would make sense if he had one more new, here you go, I'm done. And then, of course, because it's the end, and of course, because it's John Williams, you can do no wrong, we're all just going to cry and love it.
And he's just going to drop the baton and walk out.
Yep.
I'd be okay with that. Barb, what do you think? Do you think there's going to be something brand new that we just our minds melt, like we talked about last week?
I hope so.
Yeah?
Yeah. And it's John Williams. I love all of his top 8 in the top 10. So whatever he does, I'll love.
Underachiever. Only 8 of the top 10 soundtracks of all time. Well, I'm looking forward to this. Hopefully we'll get a little bit more with some future trailers. We might get a little bit more insight with that and stuff. But this is like super reaffirming good news that John Williams is looking at bringing us kind of a sampling of all those things that really tugged at our heartstrings as fans.
Yeah.
The soundtrack is a character, without question, and John Williams is going to be missed wherever things go beyond this. Let's jump into our top story of the week.
Number one.
If it sounds like there's no one around, you might be at Galaxy's Edge in Disneyland. Listen, I have talked to our good friend of the pod, Alex Iniguez, who is a Disney artist who is down there at Disneyland. That's where he goes to work every day. Fun Auntie Bex is actually down there with her family right now, and both have said crowds aren't really anywhere to be found. Some headlines are saying that it is a flop, that Galaxy's Edge was the worst spending of $1 billion that Disney has done. Disney stock has actually taken a hit and gone down since they started taking over Star Wars in 2012. It's kind of an interesting thing, what's going on or what's not going on down there at Galaxy's Edge. Let me also read you a quote from Bob Iger, who was recently at a shareholders event, and this is what he had to say. Quoting Bob Iger, "I think it's a number of things that happened. First of all, helped in part by some of our efforts, there was tremendous concern in the marketplace that there was going to be a huge crowding when we opened Galaxy's Edge. So some people stayed away just because they expected that it would not be a great guest experience." Let me just take a pause there. I certainly resonate with that.
Mm-hmm.
As someone that detests crowds, mm-hmm. that would have been one of my first top reasons to not go to Galaxy's Edge opening, be like, don't want anything to do with the crowd. Barb, how much of that do you personally resonate with?
A lot of that. You know, I was under the impression that they would still need this reservation system for a while to go.
Right.
And with the crowds that I saw opening day, I'm just like, you know, I love Disneyland, I love Star Wars, but I can wait. I can wait till I can move and breathe through all of the attractions that I want to see.
Yeah. Let me continue on here. Bob Iger continues, said, one of the other things, of course, is at the same time that all this was going on, all the local hotels in the region, expecting a huge influx of visitation, they raised their prices.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, of course they did. He continues, so it simply got more expensive to come and stay in Anaheim. In addition to that, Iger continues, we, meaning Disney, we raised our prices.
Yeah.
We brought our daily price up. So if you think about local visitation, we brought the price of a one-day ticket up substantially from a year ago, adding, of course, on top of that, the increased hotel expenses. He continues on, and then, he says, we opened up Galaxy's Edge with one attraction instead of two. Remember, the second attraction is not even open yet at Galaxy's Edge at Disneyland. The second attraction is going to open in January, he continues. And so all of those factors contributed to attendance that was below what we would have hoped for it to be. That said, guest satisfaction, interest in the attraction, and the land is extremely high. It's the most popular thing at the park. And so, long term, we build these things for the long term. We have no concerns whatsoever. By the way, if I can just segue right here, anytime you say you have no concerns whatsoever is when you have a concern about something. Anyway, continuing on with Mr. Iger. We're opening Galaxy's Edge in August in Orlando. The second attraction there will be open in December. And as I said, the second attraction, Anaheim, will open in January. So we feel great about the product we've created. It just takes some time to basically, for us, to work themselves out in terms of how the marketplace is reacting. Listen, I'm going to put on my hip waders as I'm about chest deep in manure with Bob Iger's quotes here. Regina, is this just spin for the shareholders? Do you believe that this is 100% accurate? And maybe even a larger question is, did Disney misstep here?
I think if Disney misstepped, it's probably like a little baby one. You can't deny the numbers, whether that be the revenue that has been generated or the amount of people that have been there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's way too early, way too soon, and way too much to say that it was a flop, because it literally just opened. And I mean, I'm no theme park expert, I'm no business expert, but I feel like there's going to be like peaks and highs in this industry. And to me, I'm not really surprised, especially because before I even read the article, I figured most of the reasons that he said. So they just made sense to me.
I'm curious though, because let me flip the table, Barb. If we flip that and some of the things that Bob Iger addressed there weren't true, what happens if the crowds were wall to wall and they actually had to, which they've had to do, well, I've been there before, is like close Disneyland, right? We're not going to have anybody else in until a good number of guests actually leave the park.
Mm-hmm.
If that had been the case, do you think that we'd be hailing this as like the greatest thing that Disney has ever done?
Oh gosh. I mean, is that kind of what people expected? What we saw the opening week was what people expected to last for months, right?
Right.
So it's so hard to say because, you know, I agreed with everything that Gina said. And I think that there's a lot of cynicism out there, especially when it comes to Star Wars and Disney. Mm. And as soon as things might not be exactly as expected, it's like, oh, no, was this a big failure? Was this a bad spending of $1 billion?
Yeah.
No, I know you're saying that he's shoveling a lot of manure in this article, but I think a lot of his points are valid. It's not built for the first 3 months or the first year. It's built to last. And while they didn't get the numbers they had hoped in the first, has it been 2 months, 3 months?
On the verge of three there.
Yeah. It's like, relax. As he said, there's only one attraction in there. And maybe that's why some people are feeling a little underwhelmed. But we still have Orlando to open and see what happens there.
Right.
And we still have the second attraction and years and years and years of people coming just to go to Galaxy's Edge.
Yeah.
I mean, with Celebration being in a year, you can bet your ass that it's going to be packed in there.
Sure.
So,
well, people paying all that kinds of money to come cross country specifically for Star Wars. Absolutely. I'm curious though, Barb, let me stay with you for a moment on this. You know, one of the things that he didn't bring up, and I don't know if it's something that they've realized. I mean, certainly they realized. I mean, this was obviously a conscious decision on their part. But the fact is, when it comes to the characters in Galaxy's Edge, we have Vi, who's from the Phasma novel. We have Kylo Ren. We have Rey. We have First Order troops. Mm-hmm. We have Chewbacca. We don't have any other legacy characters there. We don't have old school stormtroopers there. How much of that do you think might factor into a disinterest in this? Because the people that have the cash, that are the midlife people right now,
are the ones interested in those characters.
Right. So do you think that something might play into that part of the equation for people saying, wow, if I'm going to take the family out there, and it's going to be higher ticket prices, higher hotel costs, and I'm not going to even see Leia, Han, Luke, whomever?
It's so hard to say, because I feel like I'm one of those people too.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I grew up with the original trilogy and the legacy characters, and I want to see them too, but I still love what Star Wars is today as well as what it was in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
And it could be some of those disgruntled fan people that just don't want to pay service to something that Disney owns that should have been 20th Century Fox all the way through, you know?
Well, now they own Fox. So it, now it's
well, exactly. It's just, it's hard for me to get into the mind of somebody like that when I want to go to Galaxy's Edge and yeah. I'm of that age.
Yeah.
You know, the article's also talking about, is Star Wars appealing to the next generation, the younger generation? And yes and no. I think it just really depends. Mm. A lot of the younger generation is depending on their parents being fans and making them watch it.
Right. Making them, yes.
I just mean, like, my kid's a fan, but my kid's a fan because... Yeah. I've had her watch it.
Sure, you pass the torch.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
I pass it on.
Right.
How many absolute new fans in the young generation are they getting that aren't being influenced by parents or people who loved the original trilogy?
Yeah, let's ask one. Gina. Now, granted, you had some crossover with your dad and stuff. I know that for those that haven't heard your backstory on Star Wars on Tap and stuff. But for you... You're a grad student. You are part of the younger generation of Star Wars fans, which is great. From your perspective, do you think that there's anything to this whole legacy character bit? Or do you think that Bob Iger pretty much nailed it?
I don't understand that at all. Actually, I was thinking about... So there's this other segment that's very similar to Star Wars on Tap that Lipstick and Lightsabers does. And
yeah.
Amy Wishman actually noted that the majority of the women who have sent in their stories said they fell in love with Star Wars during The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi. And besides like adults, like over 40, everyone I've talked to fell in love with Star Wars after Disney bought it. And so for me, I was reading some of those comments and I was like, well, almost everyone I know... Not prefers over. That's the wrong word, but it's the word I'm going to use because I can't think of the correct terminology. But if they had to, they would rather watch a sequel trilogy or a prequel trilogy movie over the original trilogy. So from my little point of view, we're okay with not seeing as much of the original trilogy as much as we love those characters and that story.
Well, let me follow up with that. You know, you touched on this. We also don't have any prequel characters there. We don't have any battle droids around there. We don't have any droidicas around there. We don't have new Gunray, as far as I know. Is that something that you feel would be a good addition to this as well?
I think so. I think the other thing is that Disney is just this giant company that has so many arms and does so many things and has been successful for so long. I think... It's weird if we as a, and I'm not saying that it's a failure, but I think it's weird if we see them fail. I think Disney isn't being allowed to experiment anymore. So they can't put out this park and say, we're going to have mostly sequel trilogy characters and see how it goes. Maybe they have plans in like 3 months to include prequel trilogy characters. Maybe that. So because if you notice, like, with the merch and everything, there's, like, been a prequel reinsurgence. I feel like they're like, okay, people are kind of done hating on this. They remember how much they like it. We can introduce it. And so I feel like they're just trying different things, and we're sort of judging them before they can give us their whole plan, their whole idea.
Yeah, and I will say, when we took my daughter to Disneyland several years ago, Frozen had just come out in theaters. It wasn't even quite the sensation that it turned out to be at that point. Anna and Elsa were nowhere to be found. And even if they were there, we wouldn't have known, like, who they were, because we hadn't seen the movie at that point. All that to say is, you know, they have grown into two super popular characters. We've got another movie coming out at Epcot Center in Disney World. The Frozen ride is one of the most popular rides in the entire Epcot park.
It's a good ride.
So I think that there is something to say for, let's allow things to kind of build up and matriculate a little bit. Barb, from your perspective, if there were other characters, whether from the original trilogy, whether from the prequel trilogy, beyond those that are out there right now, it could even be somebody from one of the Star Wars stories movies, who else would you pick to put out there that would be kind of a... an attraction for you to go, like, go see that person?
From the prequels or the original trilogy?
Yeah, I mean, it could be from the sequels as well. I'm just saying, like, who are some other people that would actually be a draw? Like, I'd actually like to get my picture taken with that character, or a family photo with that character.
Maybe Anakin.
Yeah?
Any of...
7-year-old Anakin?
No, more of Revenge of the Sith Anakin. Okay. And then, like, Leia, of course, and Han and Luke. Like, that would be cool with the three of them, or and Chewie, just to get a picture like that. But it's hard because Disney went the way of making this a very immersive experience.
Right.
And to keep that, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? That fantasy alive as you're there.
Suspension of belief.
Exactly. Yeah. You can't take things that would take you out of Black Spire Outpost on Batuu, and a lot of these characters wouldn't have visited this planet, and it's at a time during the First Order. So, you know, in a way, they've kind of put themselves in a box when it comes to people wanting to see prequel characters and original trilogy characters. So it's like, do you want that more than you want this immersive experience? What is it that you want?
So far as, like, is this canon or not? Will my family vacation be considered canon or not if Leia's there? I'm curious, Regina, from your perspective, other than Pedro Pascal, is there a character that you would want to most hang out with or have your picture taken at Galaxy's Edge?
I mean, I'm in the same boat. I want Revenge of the Sith Anakin. That being my number one.
I have a feeling it's probably for the same reason. But that being said, so let me ask this then, because there was a lot of pushback when Alden Ehrenreich was chosen to play Han Solo. Doesn't look like I'm all this other stuff, right? When it comes to seeing characters at Disneyland, Disney World, portraying Leia, Han, Luke, somebody that's not in a mask or a costume, does it matter to you, Regina, like, whether that person is, like, obviously Harrison Ford ain't going to be out there taking photos at Disneyland with us. Does it matter to you if that person is not a dead-on ringer for Harrison Ford, but it's just some part-time actor that's trying to pay the bills working at Disneyland?
When I was a senior in high school, quick story time, I had the opportunity to go with my choir to go to Disney World, and we performed. And while I was there, I told my friends I wanted one thing, to meet Aladdin. They took me to the line. I was shaking. I was crying. I hugged Aladdin. I look at this photo. To this day, I will tell you, I met Aladdin. Some person's going to come up to me and say, no, that was a character in a costume. And I'll look them dead in the eyes and say, no, I met Aladdin. So, yeah, I believe that the characters are, like, legit them. Whenever I see, like videos and stuff, like, there's this video that resurfaces every so often of, like, this cute little girl meeting Loki, and obviously that's not Hiddles, but hello, that's Loki. I think you're meeting the characters, and nothing will ever take me out of that. So I will take Anakin there.
Well, I think there's something to be said for that. And, of course, for those, I'm sure all of our listeners are aware, but, like, Disney princesses, for example, they actually go to Disney Princess University, where they have to learn how to mimic the handwriting, and they have to have all of the movies, like, memorized in their parts. And, you know, if they say, like, oh, have you seen whatever SpongeBob? Well, SpongeBob doesn't exist to a Disney princess because that's not a Disney property. So, yeah, I'm with you on that. In fact, going back to the first time that we took my daughter to Disneyland, all she wanted to do was meet the princesses.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we paid ever how much money did grandma and grandpa in there with us and our kids and all that. And, it, like, rides were okay, but, like, she was okay just standing in line going to see the princesses. To a point where, like, when she came through, like, the third time of the day, they're just like, oh, hi, it's Ainsley again. And they all knew her by name, which is kind of cool. But then now, you know, she's going to turn 8 next week. And now she looks at the pictures and is like, wait a minute, that Ariel looks different from my Ariel. She's on to them. I know. But, like, I'm with you. Barb, would you agree with that? Like,
absolutely.
It's part of the spirit of being a kid. Like, well, let's suspend belief and have fun.
A kid, yeah. I mean, I've seen some videos of people meeting Rey, and they do a great job with the costume. Even though these are characters that aren't masked, you still just fall into that fantasy and you go with it. It doesn't have to look exactly like Harrison Ford or Hayden Christensen. Yeah. It's part of the magic of Star Wars, and I love it.
And I cannot wait to get back there. Hopefully by the time I do, that the restraining order against Snow White will have lifted. That being said, let's jump into our closer look for the night. So stick around. We'll be right back with tonight's closer look.
Closer.
Come closer, I have good news.
A certain point of view.
Same thing I always do, talk my way out of it.
The ability to speak does not make you intelligent.
I never ask that question until after I've done it.
You're going to find that many of the truths we cling to depend greatly on our own point of view.
Well, let's jump into part two of our two-part miniseries talking about which is the best Star Wars. Is it the pre-Disney Star Wars or is it the Disney Star Wars? Last week we talked about and made a case for, hey, here's some reasons why the Disney Star Wars maybe out-muscles the actual 6 original films by George Lucas. Well, tonight we're flipping the tables and we're going to take a look at pre-Disney Star Wars and kind of figure out where things are. This, of course, is based on an article that came out, a few weeks ago. It'll be linked in our show notes. And it's the same one we went through last week, if you happen to grab last week's show notes as well. So let's talk a little bit about this. Talking about the 6 films. We won't go into Clone Wars. We won't go into the Clone Wars animated film or the series. So we'll just start with the 6 major live-action films. One of the things that this author brings up as far as why the Lucas era, as he labels it, why the Lucas era Star Wars was better than the Disney Star Wars is, it was so bold, talking about world building, talking about character building, talking about all those things that in the 1970s, when everyone was projecting images of a spotless, shiny, unblemished future, George Lucas comes around, turns everything upside down, and gives us this really dirty, used, lived-in world. So, Barb, let me just kind of toss that out there. Do you agree with this author's premise that when it comes to the boldness of the worlds and the characters, that what Lucas gave us in those original 6 is more compelling and ultimately better than what we've gotten under the Disney umbrella?
Oh, gosh, it's so hard to say because it's the original stuff. It's the stuff that made Star Wars what it is. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these planets that Lucas dreamed up and came out with, they had such story and depth to them. And, you know, coming from this perspective of everything's old and beaten in the rebellion and I kind of want to agree with him. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I still love what we're seeing with Disney. It's just so, it's so hard. These closer looks last week and this week are just going to be hard. This one's going to be hard for me because I love the original trilogy and I love Disney. And his points are absolutely valid. And I agree with him to a certain point.
To a certain point. Regina, let me bring it to you, but let me kind of change it a little bit. You know, one of the things that George Lucas did unabashedly is he made the movies he wanted to make. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he went back and continued to work on the movies that he made, which his prerogative as the creator. So, Regina, from your perspective, do you feel that in one sense the boldness that Lucas took, quite frankly, not giving a force if people liked it or not, but making the movie that he wanted to make, is actually what we're not seeing with Disney, that we're seeing commercial successes, but we're not really seeing any envelopes being pushed other than perhaps special effects?
I'm half and half on that. If you were to ask me that question after The Force Awakens came out, I would have said that Lucas didn't care so much. He made the movies he wanted to make. And so that would be bold, just because there was a lot of things with The Force Awakens. You had to reintroduce Star Wars and all that. Mm-hmm. But after The Last Jedi, I don't really think so, because I feel like if you look at Rian Johnson's Twitter account, he doesn't care what most of the people think.
Right,
he
right.
was a Star Wars fan, and he made a Star Wars film the way he saw the story going and he wanted to. And I feel like he's very much like George Lucas in that vein, where he said, this is the story I want to tell. This is the story I'm giving you.
Mm-hmm. People listening to this in their car now, driving off the road when you're comparing Rian Johnson to George Lucas. I love that. Call our attorneys if you get in a wreck. I'm sure they can work something out for you. It's interesting, though, because I agree that Rian Johnson definitely pushed the envelope. And mm-hmm. I'm on the record for saying that I love The Last Jedi, and that's not going to change. We also have the other side to that coin, though, and that is we've had a bunch of movies, with the exception of The Last Jedi, that there were underpinnings of panic and miscommunication and hiring different directors 90% of the way through things. So, Barb, from your perspective, do you agree with what Regina was saying as far as actually Rian Johnson was super bold, and he proved that with The Last Jedi, and so tit for tat, it's fairly even?
I absolutely agree with Regina, because Rian Johnson did push it. It's just a fact. He pushed what he wanted. He pushed the envelope, and that's why a lot of people are upset. But it's a great story, and in comparison, it's exactly what George Lucas did, and he inspired Rian Johnson to do that. Mm. You talked a bit about some of the other movies there being, you know, a little more messy in the making, but those were specifically the standalone movies, not the episodic ones.
Right.
Because we're talking about Solo, and I mean, Disney has the license now for Star Wars and is seeing what it can do with it. Mm-hmm. And I think Rogue One was the beginning of really branching out beyond the episodic films. Mm-hmm. It's the first time that we've seen a feature-length live-action film that wasn't part of the episodic movies.
Right.
And so that definitely pushed the envelope. A lot of people loved it. A lot of people didn't.
Yeah. So, and they all happen to be wrong, but go ahead.
And then you've got Solo, and Solo's a great movie.
Yeah, it's a fun ride.
It really is.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell if you were being
serious. No, I'm being serious. It's a fun ride.
So, you know, George Lucas pushed the envelope so much, and now Disney's doing it in a different way.
Mm. How do you think that Disney could further push the envelope? I don't know if they'll ever do it as much as George Lucas did, right? Because George Lucas, well, he had something, right? He had clout and a bankroll.
Yeah.
Disney obviously wants to profit off of this, so they might be, by nature, a little bit more conservative. But notwithstanding, like, where do you think that Disney could actually branch out and push the envelope a little bit? Or do you think that, we talked about Disney Plus, the things that we're going to see live action on that medium are going to be the result of pushing the envelope?
Yeah, exactly. I think that that's what they are doing. You know, we're going to have The Mandalorian in November, and that's pushing the envelope even further.
Yeah.
And we have the animated series, first Rebels and now Resistance. Mm-hmm. And again, it's just expanding what the Star Wars universe looks like beyond the films.
Yeah.
I can't speak to what else they could do. It's why I'm not on their creative team.
Who knows? Maybe the email went to spam by mistake.
Yeah.
I'm curious. The author continues on, and he says, you know, one of the things that the Lucas era did better, and that was the creation and, I guess, the continuing story of the villains. The villains. Of course, you think back to the Lucas era Star Wars. I mean, first and foremost, Vader is one of the most iconic villains in cinema history, not just Star Wars. We look at the prequels. We've got General Grievous. Of course, we've got Count Dooku. We've got Palpatine. We can look at other more second-tier folks like Director Krennic, Governor Tarkin. Regina, from your perspective, if you were going to kind of make a little tally sheet and put Lucas-era villains on one side and Disney-era villains on the other, who do you think comes out ahead?
As a whole, I have to say it's the Lucas-era villains, but I kind of disagree with what the author of this article said, because, so if you just take the original trilogy, you don't really get Palpatine until Return of the Jedi. Right. I never thought Vader was that great of a villain. I never thought Vader was scary. I never thought Vader was intimidating. Kind of didn't like, I mean, James Earl Jones was fantastic, but that was the only, like, good, for lack of a better word, thing I liked about Vader. In fact, I wasn't intimidated by Vader until the end of Rogue One. And then I was like, oh, this is what everyone else has been seeing. I finally get it. But it took until that film for me to get it. If you look at the sequel trilogy, we have Snoke. That's the only villain I see. Or I guess General Hux. But And both of their stories have, like, I don't know if we're going to get a Snoke backstory, but we don't really know what was going on with him. And Hux's story hasn't been complete. So I'm just kind of like, yeah, Lucas, there's General Grievous. There's all these more villains that have been, like, developed and whatnot. We only have two villains in the sequel trilogy, in my opinion.
And you would classify those as Hux and Snoke?
Yeah.
Okay, so where do you put Kylo?
Mm-hmm. He is a protagonist. Him and Rey are two halves of a whole.
Oh my gosh. Girl, we gotta talk off air. Well, and I put, look, you know, Phasma is the sequel version of Boba Fett.
Oh,
I
snap. Mean, forgot about her.
Yeah, that's all right. It's all right. But I think that, you know, one of the things that, and of course, if this is the Skywalker saga, it would be natural to have this extended, in-depth look at Vader. But I think that's one of the things that the sequel trilogy has run into as a challenge that to this point they haven't really dealt with as well as I had hoped, and that is we've got so many potential baddies, but none of them really have enough depth to them. Mm-hmm. For as much as I love The Last Jedi, it was Rey and Kylo, right? Had we gotten some more story on Hux? Hux clearly does not like Kylo Ren. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that. Let's see some more interplay between those two, or what Hux is doing when Kylo's not there to try to undermine his rule. I think that we're going to see some more of Hux in episode 9 and maybe in some surprising ways. But I have to personally go with Lucas on this. What do you think, Barb?
I definitely am with Lucas on this. And, you know, just to kind of go against a little bit of what Gina said on Vader. I know. Sorry, Gina. But so Vader, you know, growing up watching Star Wars, you become very used to Vader. And, you know, the fear factor of him as a villain fades. Mm. But when you really think about Vader and his presence, you've got this dark, like all black looming shadow, completely masked. Mm. And there was this time when I was looking at the Vader mask in what looked to be close to actual size that you have, Devin. You had it in here.
Yeah.
And I was staring.
It's behind you, by the way.
I was staring at that thing and I'm like, okay, Vader's scary. You know, if you had this tall black,
it's like 6'5" or so.
Yeah. Masked villain looming over you like he is in so many of these posters, he's scary. And we've become so used to him in Star Wars that we love him as a villain and love his character and love his story and love his backstory and everything about him. But yeah, Rogue One did a great job to help show how bad he is. But again, to, you know, bring this back to the comparison of villains, Lucas knocks it out of the park compared to Disney. And I don't know what Disney's going to do with villains. Bring back Palpatine is what they're doing. So,
well, and we'll see how that plays out. And I think that they're going to have an opportunity. Remember, we've got at least two live action shows coming. We've got at least two trilogies looming out there. So I think we're going to get an opportunity for villains. It's interesting, though, because just to testify as to like the imposing figure that Vader is, when I was seeing Star Wars, I don't know if it was like second, third time, whatever it was, but back in 1977, my cousin, who's a year younger than myself, so he was four at the time, this will attest to how scary Vader is. The kid peed himself in the theater seat. For as soon as he walked in, Leia's ship, peed himself. That is great. He's still talking about it, right?
I mean, my oldest kid hides behind the couch every time Vader comes on screen. Wow. She's legitimately scared of Vader.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Know what mommy's going to dress up for Halloween as. How about this? The author kind of takes a little bit of a turn. And again, so much of this is subjective, right? But I thought this was kind of interesting. Goes in and he talks about, you know, when it comes to the Lucas era, better costume design. And, of course, I think that, you know, when it comes to especially the prequels, who could argue against the incredible wardrobes of Padme? No doubt about it. But if we take that and just kind of put it off the side, do you think overall, Barb, that the costume design is better under Lucas than it is the Disney era?
I think so.
Really?
I think the Disney era has done a good job with the costumes that are appropriate for the storyline. So, I mean, when you're talking about it in comparison to stories, it's closer, but there's just, they're much more elaborate in the Lucasfilm. And all I keep thinking of when it was talking about this and the costume design is that one shot of Queen Amidala looking out the window. As the battleships are coming. It's just, it's so elaborate and epic and kind of just adds so much to the story of the character as well as what's going on.
Yeah.
And we don't see that quite as much in Disney. I mean, Phasma's pretty cool, you know, her whole costume
just, agree with you.
You know, and if I think in depth, it's just the elaborateness is not there.
Do you think that that is something that in episode 9 we're going to see some shifts in that?
Possibly. I mean, again, it's hard to speculate where they're going to go with episode 9.
I think there was some great, and I know some folks don't like it, but like the scene at Canto Bight, I thought had some incredible design when it came to the costume. And I would even say, you mentioned Solo earlier, I think the costuming in Solo.
Oh, there were a really few costumes that...
You know, I mean, Enfys Nest, my goodness.
Enfys Nest was cool. There was this one scene, though, I'm like, what is she wearing? You know, sometimes it just looks like they're trying over the top.
Yeah.
When they go to see, and his name's going to escape me, but Paul Bettany's character.
Yeah.
And
Dryden Vos.
Dryden Vos, thank you. And this woman dressed in gold is walking. I'm just like, really? That's a lot. But maybe that's...
Barb, it could be because you're more of like a summer and she's fall.
I don't know.
I just lost our male listeners on that, but
and Canto Bight was not my favorite scene in The Last Jedi.
Yeah,
so
it wasn't mine
so it doesn't like, stick out in my mind. But you're right, there's some cool costumes
there.
Yeah,
I thought it had some pretty cool. And I would even say like Rogue One when we've got who is it, Billy Two Tubes or whatever his name is, when he and his twin. I thought that was like some super creative stuff that they came up with. But I mean, as far as regalness goes, I mean, anything that's going to have Coruscant in it, right? Or anything from Naboo is going to obviously have some pretty amazing stuff. Regina, what are some of your thoughts on this? Would you default to the Lucas era stuff, or do you actually stick with kind of Disney when it comes to this as well?
I actually, the costumes in both are impressive. So I don't stick with any of them. I feel like they're even. So the article was talking about setting and how that dictates what you wear. So of course, when you go to Canto Bight, they're dressed up way more extravagant and super, super pretty. And then you have outliers like Holdo. And then the prequel has outliers like Padme. But when I thought about it, I was like, they dressed to their occasion. I feel like everyone is just dressed like you would be in Star Wars. I don't think that in that case there's someone has a level up because the outfit is based off of environment and character personality and what's needed. And since different stories are being told in each of the trilogies, they're just outfits to me. And some are really pretty.
Yeah. And I think you do bring up a great point with that, too. I mean, right? Location, location, location. I mean, obviously, you're not going to dress on Tatooine to survive the desert heat, or Jakku for that matter, like you would on someplace like Coruscant or wherever else that you might be within the galaxy. Which brings up one of the other things the author brings up is that is location-wise. Now, he kind of splits some hairs here, and he says, well, you know, as far as the variety of location, Lucas era does a better job giving us a variety of locations. And then he kind of splits hairs and says, but the unique locations really belong under the Disney umbrella. That's splitting some pretty fine hairs when that comes to it. Just as a personal favorite, Regina, where are you? Is there kind of some planets or some locales that you tend to resonate most with as a fan?
I feel so bad because I'm like Eve last week. I'm on the fence about so many things.
Man, I know. And we got rid of her this week, so you could be next.
If you asked me which places I resonate more with, I would tell you something from the sequel trilogy because that's my Star Wars and it's what I watch the most. But if you were to ask me what is the places I want to visit, the places that have me most like encaptured and in awe, it's the different planets that are in the prequel trilogy.
Naboo, or are there other areas that really capture your imagination?
And Coruscant, both of those places I would love to visit.
Yeah. I tend to kind of go myself towards the Disney era on this.
Yeah.
Listen, I love Naboo. And Gina, I thought you put it great. Like, hey, if I was going to go on vacation somewhere, like I wouldn't go on vacation to Crate, right? But I think visually it was so compelling to me. I think Scarif, I would probably go on vacation.
Scarif. Oh, yeah.
Real estate's dirt cheap. But I really got to go, you know, like Maz Kanata on Takodana. And honestly, like the Ring of Kafreen, which is the beginning of Rogue One when Cassian kills his own guy. I love that. I absolutely love that. I wouldn't want to go there, but it reminded me so much of what I've seen on like National Geographic or Discovery when it's like these Middle Eastern markets that are just jam packed with folks and vendors and people buying stuff. And I love that. Barb, from your perspective, where do you tend to kind of resonate most with?
I think Disney.
Yeah.
And yeah, because as you said, there's just some planets there like Octu. It's beautiful. I like the isolation. I can't stand Coruscant. The last thing I want to do is go to a big city.
but as like as far as compelling visuals and what was
and
there.
And that's what I mean is visually you've got Maz Kanata's, oh gosh, you just said the planet Takodana
Taco Tuesday,
which is, I mean, the landscape is breathtaking as they're flying in. Even Rey says it, like I never knew there was so much green.
Right, what a great line.
Yeah. And then the same with Octu. It's this jagged rock sticking out of the ocean. Mm. And it's beautiful and majestic to me. And even when you look at Rogue One, as well as Solo, Corellia's kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's a lot more of the metallic stuff that doesn't resonate with me as much as the natural does. But
then the snowy mountains in Solo that were great.
Yes. But then you compare that to Hoth in Empire Strikes Back, which was great. When you see Wedge flying over the mountains, that again is a scene that I love, and I love the snow. So I don't want to be on the fence because everybody's on the fence.
I'm not on the fence. I will take the Disney locations.
Yeah, the Disney locations are just a lot more majestic to me, and I love that.
Yeah, they're more intriguing. At least visually, I dig them a lot more. I think honestly, and there's a poster of it. I don't know why I don't have. Well, I know why I don't have it in the studio because there ain't no more room on the walls in the studio. But there's this great. It's actually part of the film, and someone just made a poster out of. But it's the resistance rushing towards the First Order on Crait, and it's these lines of red contrasting with the white salt, and it's just mesmerizing. So mesmerizing to me. All right, well, this author continues on, and, you know, one of the other things that he talks about when it comes to Lucas era versus the Disney era is that he feels that the Lucas era Star Wars, as he puts it, can stand on its own, where it doesn't necessarily need more. At one point, we didn't know we were going to get anything beyond Episode 6, Return of the Jedi. But maybe, just maybe, that the Disney era stuff is kind of just kind of like this newborn calf. It's kind of having a little bit of a trouble finding its legs and standing up on its own. Maybe that will change come December 19th of this year, and it will be its own thing. Regina, I would tend to say that you would probably disagree with the author here, that you think that Disney Star Wars is doing just fine.
Okay, so Disney Star Wars is doing just fine. I think that the original trilogy does stand on its own the best. What was I listening to today? I think it was Clashing Sabers was having a conversation very similar to this, where it's like the things you said, when they made A New Hope, it could stand on its own. Who knew if we were going to get more? The original trilogy is self-contained. Of course, the prequels has to tell the story of how we got to the original trilogy, so it's super dependent on it because it's stuck in those confines. This was actually something I was thinking about when we were talking about the John Williams score and revisiting all of the other music. It's actually something I've been thinking about with the sequel trilogy a lot, and the fact that I like it. I don't dislike much, honestly. It takes a lot for me to dislike it, so I'm content with what we have. But I've been thinking about how this next film has to wrap up this entire saga, so of course we're going to revisit maybe important places, important characters that we've already had. But I sort of felt like we've been so dependent on saying, this is where our original trio went, this is what happened to them, this is their music, this is their story, that I'm sort of like, okay, but what about the new guys? Like, I could get, like, The Force Awakens, this is what happened, woo, they're still important in the story. I'm not saying I didn't want them in the story, but at some point, I want a lot more focus on the characters that we have now, and I'm not sure that I'm completely satisfied with that. If we had more focus on our new characters, then it could be its entire own thing, like, independent, but I'm not sure we're there, and I don't know if we're going to get there with this last film.
I mean, you bring up so many compelling things to talk about. I mean, first and foremost, as you were talking about the prequels, I thought, you know, it'd be interesting looking at, did the prequels stand up well if it were just them? And I think, like, yes, if we would have had erased episodes 4 through 9, I think the prequels actually go like, oh my gosh. Like, he was supposed to be the chosen one, and now he's, like, burnt up, and, like, it's just ending. I want more. Like, that's compelling enough to me to go, like, oh, I would want more if we didn't already have more. I think it's also interesting, Gino, when you talk about the sequels, when it comes to delving into the new characters. Disney obviously made an interesting choice at some point, right? They had to decide where that balance was between handing off the torch to the new kids and still having a wink and a nod to the original cast. And I don't know if what they did was right or wrong. I dig where they've gone with things thus far. And I also agree with the other part of what you said, is that, but wouldn't it be great to get more story with our three main characters, Poe, Rey, Finn? I guess we can throw Kylo in there. But if we do those guys, plus we're throwing in Hux, plus we're throwing in Snoke, plus we're throwing in Phasma, well, and Han, Leia, Luke, Chewbacca, like, that's a heavy card.
Well, and there's the fact that The Last Jedi gave us Rose, and The Rise of Skywalker is giving us Janna, and I'm just like, there's so many characters. I want everything.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Well, but we want everything, like, done to depths that we can appreciate it, though, right? Like,
right.
Rose is a great character. Like, thank you for bringing her up. And at the same time, it's like, oh, yeah, we didn't really get much of that, you know? So hopefully we get some more. I do hope that these Star Wars sequel characters live on beyond Episode 9. I hope we get to see them elsewhere.
Yes.
at some point anyway. Barbara, to kind of wrap this up, any other thoughts as far as Lucas era versus Disney era Star Wars?
I mean, we've kind of covered a lot of it, and it's sometimes hard to compare them when they're so different and similar at the same time,
yeah.
You know, because Disney relies on Lucas to have it, you know,
right.
You can't say that the Disney era can stand alone when the story is based on Lucas.
Right.
And Lucas films will always have that place in our heart of when we first saw it and when we first saw Star Wars and what gave us that first love of it, at
right.
least for the generation that isn't growing up on Disney Star Wars.
Right.
So it's a hard thing that the author of this article has done in comparing the two, because they both have their strengths, they both have their weaknesses, but we're talking about Star Wars and George Lucas created it, so...
No doubt. And look, it's such a subjective thing, right?
Exactly.
And I think that's part of the beauty of fandom, though. We have our favorite characters, our favorite locales, our favorite villains, and my goodness, if not for those things, you know, I'm on the record, I don't know how many times on this podcast, saying... I've got a better, I guess, opportunity, or it's easier for me to pick which one of my kids I prefer over which Star Wars movie I prefer. Because the great thing about all these movies that we have is there's a time and place for all of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think Solo's a great movie just to kind of pop in if you want just like some fun.
Yeah.
I think The Last Jedi is not the movie you pop in for fun. You know? But that's great, though, because if you're in, like, a serious mood, like, there's a contemplative mood, like, man, Last Jedi is great for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, all that to say, I'm excited where things are going.
Absolutely.
Where
yep,
we've been
yeah.
is incredible. And what's great about this is, you know, Barb, you mentioned it earlier in the show, and that is your kids are Star Wars fans because, you know, you withheld food for a week or so. Force them to eventually watch it. But that's part of the beauty of Star Wars to begin with,
mm-hmm.
right? It's passing it from generation to generation. Jeremy, I know, has talked about both on and off the pod when his father first took him to see it and just remembers that. And then Jeremy took his dad and his son Sam to see The Force Awakens. And
yeah.
so that's just cool.
Yeah.
For so many generations, we've had other things, whether it's love for a sports team or whatever else. But this is truly something that is multi-generational. And I think that in and of itself, whether you resonate with Lucas era or Disney era, whichever, like, it's just cool that it's something that could be shared on so many levels.
Yeah, definitely.
Tauntauns, we ain't done with you. Stick around. We'll be right back.
We're not done yet.
Oh, man. Well, you've probably noticed by now, dear listener, that Eve isn't with us tonight. She is actually off on special assignment, which just means that she's not feeling too well tonight. So with that in mind, I know that she would appreciate all of your positive vibes you can extend to her. But we, of course, want to thank you for hanging out with us. If you are brand new to the USW family, we are so stoked that you found us. And however you found us, congratulations. You did it. We're here. Yay. It is a great time when we get to share some of our thoughts with you, and we would love to know some of your thoughts on anything that we've talked about tonight, whether it's Disney era versus Lucas era, Star Wars, whether it is Star Wars Land Galaxy's Edge of Flop, 135 minutes of John Williams enough. Well, there's no such thing as enough John Williams, dear listener, but you know what I mean. We want to hear from you. You can always, always, always find us on that wretched hive of scum and villainy known as the Twitter at UnmistakablySW. You can also email us at unmistakablystarwars@gmail.com. And, of course, you can leave us a voicemail, or, heck, you can even text us at the World Headquarters Hotline at 929-525-1977. With that, I also want to encourage you, dear listener, if you feel like maybe you need an outlet for your fandom, we would love to provide an opportunity for you to share your fandom with others. Right now, we're looking for some bloggers, so if you would like to potentially explore what it takes to be part of USW's blogging team, then cool. Swing on over to unmistakablystarwars.com. There's some links there for you to check out. You can send us some information about yourself, as long as you're interested, we'll get the ball rolling and get back with you as soon as we can. And as always, we could not do this. Let me just up the game. We would not do this without our beloved patrons. For each and every one of you that have committed financial resources to this podcast, we are so humbled and thankful for you, and we are so glad that we are in this together. That, of course, speaking of clashing shavers, Brandon Boylan, Jim Capron, Derek DuVernay, Dave Hackerson, Michelle Grandine, Matthew Keegan, Chris Letty, Steve Long, Neil Lowry, Mario Piper, Kyle Russell of Tumbling Saber, Regina Sanders of Unmistakably Star Wars, Connie Shee, Aaron Sinner, Skip Skipton, Krista Smolinski, Franklin Taylor, Rick Villanueva, Mike Award, and the always fabulous Mrs. Amy Wishman. We thank each and every one of you guys, and we hope that you're enjoying your USW perks and patron exclusive stuff that you can find on patreon.com. That's going to do it for this episode, my little tauntauns. The circle is now complete. We'll see you next time in the digital docking bay. And until then, may the force be with you.
Unmistakably Star Wars is a member of the Star Wars Escape Pods Network. Explore more great content and get to know our sister shows at weareescapepods.com and on Twitter at weareescapepods. The Star Wars Escape Pods Network, promoting positivity in fandom.